Here's an experiment to begin with. Welcome to 1 Million Experiments.
Still a podcast exploring how we redefine and create safety for a world without policing and prisons.
I'm Damon.
I'm Kiss.
And we stole the keys. We're coming back. We know that we said we were done, but we got some bonus work for you. We snuck back into the lab, and we could not stop experimenting with our people.
It's like some real, like, James Bond shit where, like, there's, like, a bubbling vat of acid in the middle, and he has to, like, get past the security and the retina scan and all. Yeah, we're back in the lab.
James Bond meets Senior Prank Week.
Absolutely. Yeah, we got matching t-shirts.
We might let some frogs loose in the hallway. You know that.
And if we're going to be doing all this decriminalization mischief over here, you know who we got to have back in the lab with us. Friends, you know her. You love her. She's a goddamn champ. Even a gal is here.
Yeah. Bruh. Ribbit.
Oh, wow. Yes.
What up, gang?
Hey, y'all.
Eva, it's as if we never left. How are you doing? How has your last couple, you know, non-1ME months been?
I won't say I'm bereft. It's the months have been great, but I've missed y'all. And, you know, the hypotheses are still bubbling. The lab is still there, and I'm glad to hop back in.
So metaphors aside, just so that you'll know, this is a bonus episode. We may, who knows, do this from time to time when there's an experiment we need to talk to. And we need to bring to y'all. So consider yourself lucky you got a little extra. You know, like when they throw like a couple extra nuggets in there. Here's what you get. Eva, who are we talking to today?
You know, we could not leave it without talking to Collective Justice. For the past 10 years, Collective Justice is an organization that has brought together a diverse group of survivors and imprisoned community members in Washington state. They build responses to harm that center the dignity and resilience of all people and harness the collective power of communities impacted by the trauma of violence and mass imprisonment toward cultural and systemic transformation. A Collective Justice has just many areas of work. We get into it in the conversation with Martina and Matt about all of those tentacles, but it centers around sort of four pillars. That's the healing circles that they hold, the dialogue and accountability processes, the Survivor Organizing Academy, and trainings and presentations, of which you should avail yourself if you ever get the opportunity. We go in depth about a couple of these pillars. But just as an overview, the healing circles are healing and accountability circles, both in prison and in the community, for people on all sides of harm. This is where community members come together, drawing on restorative justice practices and transformative justice principles. They build skills and wellness around coping with triggers, self and community care, and building resilience. And we also go in a little bit more detail about the dialogue and accountability processes, DAP. These are healing and accountability processes where people who have survived or lost loved ones to violence can have face-to-face dialogues with those who have caused harm. Talking in a safe setting can allow those harmed to give full voice to their experience and all that they endured. Survivors may want to ask questions about what happened, express the impact, and make requests for repair. People responsible for harm, no matter how severe, are given the opportunity to face the often wide-ranging and complex impact of their actions and work towards their own accountability. So we are so lucky to have Martina Cartman, the capacity building director and a co-founder of Collective Justice, and Matt Murphy, the dialogue and accountability process director, in the lab today.
Before we hop in, a couple housekeeping notes. One, you've heard us mention it before, but we are on the road this year in the field, sharing our findings, sharing this 1 Million Experiments film. Over the course of the year, we'll be in New York, the Twin Cities, Detroit, Seattle, Puerto Rico, and of course here in Chicago, as well as other screenings all over the country, all over this land. If you would like to bring this film to your campus, your community, your organization, your space, hit us up at contact@respairmedia.com or check out millionexperiments.com/documentary. All right, y'all. With that, like we never left, let's hop into the lab with Collective Justice.
Here's an experiment to begin with.
All right, y'all. Welcome back into the lab. We have joining us Martina and Matt from Collective Justice. Welcome.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Bruh, beep, bruh, beep, bruh.
We had to dust those off for this bonus episode. You know, the air horns been getting dusty.
They got a little rusty.
Welcome to the show. Welcome to the lab. We're so excited to have you here. And I think we'll start with the same two-part question that we start all of our conversations with, which is, in this time, however you define time, this hour, this day, this season, this lifetime, how is the world treating you and how are you treating the world?
Yeah, man, racial capitalism is killing me, you know, having to survive that. And then also, like, you don't survive it by yourself. You got family members, you got community members that are also being killed under the weight of it. It's killing me to see what's happening over in Palestine. I can feel the impact of what it's like to have ancestors who survived genocide and to see it at firsthand. And then sitting with myself and having to consider, what am I doing to fight back against what is happening and make sense of it all and my place. And at the same time, I feel blessed. I feel gratitude. I laughed so hard this morning that I almost threw my back out, like, literally.
Are you okay? Is it back
in?
Yeah,
seriously. Okay. I'm okay. It was touch and go for a second. I was like, should I keep laughing or not?
What had you going so much, if you don't mind me asking?
Just seeing family, man. Seeing how they treat each other with so much love. You know, I believe in the medicine. I believe in our ancestors being with us. And I feel them. And I believe we are medicine. And I'm trying to honor them and honor us all by meeting the world with all the love and compassion and care that it deserves, that it's worthy of, that it was born with, that it can't be stripped of. Even though I'm tired and we're all tired and we're holding ceremony and we're singing and we're dancing and we're throwing our backs out.
I don't believe that's what Ice Cube meant when he said you could do it, put your back into it.
Yeah.
He didn't mean sacrifice your back.
Yeah.
We need your spirit and we need your back, but I'm glad that
don't offer your back on an altar. Like, hold on to your back.
I swear, I kept laughing too. I was like, is it? It feels like it's going to happen. And I was like, well, I'm going to let this run its course and see.
I'm glad we got
I'm glad
that
you're
on
here.
Record.
You're here and you're upright. Martina, welcome. How is the world treating you and how are you treating the world?
The world is treating me like a whole human, giving me all the reason to feel into the full range of emotion, I would say. At this time, I'm holding grief and sorrow in my own internal world and in terms of the impact of global capitalism right now, grieving for Palestine. And I'm also feeling into like just deep joy and reverence for community and love feels very present and alive in my life. And I get to be reminded of how precious life is right now. And try to remember compassion and tenderness.
Appreciation, for you meeting us.
In hard work.
Space. Yeah. And so, you know, we snuck back into the lab after the second term and do a little extra credit, but we still ain't no better at the scientific method. We go fumble through this. As we are here, we would love to hear what was the hypothesis of the work organizationally or for either of you in terms of participating in what is this container that is Collective Justice.
I tell you my hypothesis.
The claim for Collective Justice and for the work that we're in broadly is that if we actually cared about addressing violence, if we actually cared about uprooting the conditions that lead to violence, if we actually cared about people having healing and wellness and access to joy, then we wouldn't rely on policings and prisons to do it. If we're serious then about ending mass incarceration, about ending state violence, then we need everyday people to build the skills to respond to and repair harm. I would say that's the premise. We want to create actual tangible strategies that address both mass incarceration and violence and interpersonal violence. And we don't believe that those two things are separate. That's the same project. We're in the work all the time of building out the skill and capacity amongst our own collective members, our own staff, and then our community, particularly the folks most impacted by violence. We're real busy trying to build up the skills to do just that. And we believe that is part of a larger ecosystem. So it's just one way that we can build a world where prisons and policing is obsolete.
And so what I'm hearing in that is the need for those skills to become like not just some specialized thing that you call in an external person to come bring that expertise. The idea is that people will build those muscles, have those tools in their toolbox as they move through the world, as they move through conflict. Does that sound right?
Yeah, that sounds exactly right. When you asked us that question of origin story, it feels like we could tell the origin story of collective justice, and we could tell the story of each member of collective justice as an individual, and they would be the same, right? Like they would be so deeply intertwined, because we all come to the work as people who have been impacted and come to the work as people who are fighting for freedom and liberation.
Yeah, we don't have the whole crew we want to help, but for y'all, in that intertwined, let's talk a little bit about the formation of this container and how y'all each came to it.
Came to the work as a survivor, as a Kanakoli man, as a second generation gang member, as the third generation in my family to be incarcerated. My father was born in a prison. He's in prison now. I came to this work as a mess. I went to prison at 17 years old, causing serious harm in my own community. I was incarcerated for 15 years, trying to work out all the pain, the sorrow, the grief, the anger, everything the world told me that I had to be and I needed to be. Fighting for the very little that we're afforded inside. You know, they said the belly of the beast. With a lot of people who look like me, and a lot of people who were from my neighborhood and I went to school with. And I would say, like, fast forward to 2017, 12 years into my prison sentence, I was in a prison and I was taking all the classes looking for answers. I'm 27 years old. My brain is starting to be fully developed. I'm searching to understand what I know is true in my body and my bones and what I've survived and I'm currently surviving and everyone around me is surviving and the things reconcile with the things that I have done because I didn't know what else to do. I had the opportunity to participate in Circle and sit in Circle for 15 months, meeting every single week for 3 hours with the same group of men who were incarcerated for causing serious harm. We sat in that circle and we processed and we talked about all of the things, our own survivorship. What does it mean to actually practice accountability? All the brilliant ways that we have survived, how do we honor those? At the same time, honor our dignity and our value as human beings, whole human beings. And how do we make better choices so that we don't go on to cause further harm? Because that's what true accountability is. And I sat in that circle and we talked about a million things. I mean, 15 months, it was a very, very long process. And that was my entry point to collective justice. I went from a circle participant, person who holds space, and facilitator, to unpaid intern, paid intern, facilitator, coordinator. Now I get to work with the team and they hold me as their program director. And it's a beautiful thing to be a part of the collective.
Before we go any further, I just want to celebrate you. I pay tribute and honor to the journey itself, right? Like the fact that this you know, transformative line is something that you could stand and give testimony to. It's just victory in itself. But then I thank you for it not just being, you know, a success story, right? Like, I think a lot of times, like neoliberal way, we talk about incarcerated peoples. It is, look at how I did good, right? Or look at how I am better, kind of subtly as this affirmation of the rehabilitation mythology, right? But what I hear and how you just named and landed that story is like, my transformation is interconnected with continuing to do the work that is then invested in others' transformation. And so, yeah, I don't yet have a profound question because I was just receiving all of your story and just am humbled and grateful for it. So I have a lot that's in me, but maybe I'll come back to it and invite Martina in to, you know, from us understanding like what this space makes possible and maybe does at its highest form. What was your entry point and how did collective justice come into being?
Yeah, I come into the work as a survivor of gender-based violence. And I was a college student my freshman year and sophomore year. And I was what was then called Women's Studies is now Gender, Women and Sexuality Studies major. And that
shout
was
out
a place
to the,
where
the G
I,
and second S, you know?
Evolution.
Yeah, yeah.
That was a place for me. I mean, I stumbled into it, right? Like I took a class and I got to hear stories and learn about a history and a political context for my personal story that made sense. And that was huge for me. And at the same time, I was actively surviving violence and working at the Women's Center, working at a shelter downtown for women, like doing all these things and myself actively surviving violence and doing so in isolation, not feeling like I could share and feeling deep shame for my own survivorship. And ultimately, still found that my first responders were my friends. It was a professor. It was a few people in my life who I could start talking to. I know you guys interviewed our friends at APHI. They have the Natural Helpers Program. And so much of that theory of change feels so true for me, right? Like our first responders are each other. And so what happens when you reach out to the people around you and they do or don't have the skills to support you? That's a matter of life or death for people. And I was in a place in my life where my first responders fumbled a lot and didn't have the skill, but the relationships still got me through. Like non-judgment and the couch to sleep on and the friends to check on me are the thing that ultimately pulled me out of that. But at one point, the police were called on my behalf. And so I ended up in the criminal legal system as a named victim of violence. And before I had the language to make sense of it all, I felt really clear inside of my own body that that wasn't where I wanted to get safety or healing. And that, in fact, it wasn't offering that to me at all. It was also not the place I wanted the person who I knew so well and cared about so deeply to get his accountability. And I knew that wasn't what was going to happen. Like, I just felt clear about that. Like, what I encountered in those moments was deep sort of disorienting narratives where I'm promised safety and I'm promised accountability and it doesn't feel true inside of my body and I'm also not getting it or seeing it. And that just sort of like doubles down on the shame and isolation that survivorship can often bring. Mm-hmm. And so in the course of, and right after that experience, I ended up doing what I needed to do to survive. And I was arrested that summer for a crime that carried a 15 to life sentence. And so sort of, I, in a very short period of time, got to experience the criminal legal system as a named victim and then as a defendant. And in the chaos of pretrial arrests and jail time and community supervision that I was on, fighting with my public defender, I became really unwell. Like I couldn't talk to anyone. I don't, you know, your defense attorney, if you've got a good one, is going to tell you not to talk and say anything. And so I can't share with my loved ones because they can become witnesses. I wasn't trustful or ready for like any kind of therapy. And so I just held it in and I was 20. And so I got like literal physical manifestations of the fear and the terror that I was holding inside of my body when I saw you know, documents that say the United States government versus Martina Cartman, the power of the state feels really real. And so I got alopecia and a tumor and pneumonia, and my body was just screaming to me to like stay safe, right? Like screaming to me to find wellness. And I was in survival mode. And so I just kept pushing through. And so I ended up on community supervision for like around 7 years. I ultimately got a pretrial diversion, got my bachelor's degree, and then I went on to law school and got my law degree. And in many ways, like escaped or was sort of offered an opportunity for something different. And my case had 30 other co-defendants, none of which looked like me, all of which were Black, including my best friend and her partner. And I'm the only person that got offered a diversion. And that wasn't because of any like difference in evidence or even cooperation. I just got offered diversion. Like that just lifted the veil off any confusion you might have about who the criminal legal system is intended to target and why. And so I left that experience. I walked away feeling extremely clear about the deeply dehumanizing and traumatizing project of prisons and policing. I felt extremely clear about the difference between punishment and accountability. And I felt clear that the grace I was ultimately granted paled in comparison to the harm that's perpetuated every day against Black, Indigenous, and people of color and undocumented people in our criminal justice system. And so I just like threw myself, partially because of like survivor guilt, threw myself full force into organizing work, organizing around the criminal legal system, around prison conditions, and around racism in this country. Ultimately landed myself in like two different spaces. I was sort of compartmentalizing. So one space was that of organizing for people who are currently incarcerated, and the other was spaces for survivors. And they didn't feel like you could be a whole person for me in either. Because so often in those spaces, the work is seen as in opposition of one another or mutually exclusive. And so it wasn't until I like stumbled into restorative and transformative justice spaces and trainings and workshops that I got to encounter people who could hold the complexity of what it means to fight for the dignity and humanity of survivors and what it means to fight for the dignity and humanity of people who are inside or people who've caused harm, who are always also survivors too. And that's where I just was like, oh, I'm home. I'm going to stay here forever. And I've been there ever since. And that is also part of the origin story of collective justice. It was really birthed out of the needs of survivors and people who caused harm, specifically in Washington State, specifically in the Pacific Northwest near Seattle and at Washington State Reformatory, which is a prison here about 2 hours away from the city. The origin story of CJ is an origin story of groups of people coming together who were having the same conversations. And those were folks at Washington State Reformatory, at the Concerned Lifers Organization and the Black Prisoners Caucus, at WSR, who are two organizations that have been around for decades here inside, organizing, advocating as people serving life and long-term sentences in prison. They were starting to form circles and doing politicized healing work and talking specifically about restorative justice and sort of how to live amends and do accountability from inside. And then at the same time, the Northwest Network and APHIA were holding Girl, We Got You, which was like a TJ series for survivors with Kiyomi Fujikawa and Shannon Perez Darby, Leah Lakshmi, Priya Rai, a whole lot of people were involved in that. And that was really like a skill-based series. And that too grew out of the impetus of like longer-term organizing. So all of it was happening. And CJ was a place where we decided to try to start building a political home for folks doing both work, that we could like come together and build together. That was really inspired by and based off people like Miriam Kaba, like Sonia Shah, like Erica Miners, Dean Spade, Karina Montag, all of who like helped counsel us in the beginning. And CJ's wasn't called CJ at the time, but the first thing we did was start these circles inside at WSR alongside the leaders inside. Like the theory of change was, we already have people doing this work. We already are seeing so many leaders inside yearning for some skills and some support to deepen in their own practice. Let's do that. Let's like provide the resources for that. One of the strategies of the state is to not allow people who are incarcerated to meet without an outside person there. And that's a way that we can interrupt organizing that can happen inside. And so that's true for Washington. And so us, even just like our physical presence makes it possible for these groups to meet and start practicing restorative and transformative justice work. And so we did that. The idea was we had three circles. Every circle will have a couple of people who are already like practiced leaders inside, or like clear politicized leaders doing their own work. And then some folks who are newer to the mix. And in that way, we can build a lot of collective power. We thought it would be like 6 months a year, 8 months maybe, and then train them up to do it themselves and hand it off. Then they can take it and do what they want with the curriculum, with the workbooks and everything we've created together. It ended up being 15 months because we wrote it as we went. We were like, all right, let's sit in circle, do a thing, see what arises. And then really what comes up is what we want to tend to. And so it wasn't like prescriptive or dogmatic, but instead really emergent. And as things came up, we added, like, a lot came up around patriarchy. And we were like, oh, let's write a chapter on patriarchy and the connection to violence. And so then we did that. And then that was going to be a week, and it was 3 months. And, you know, so that's kind of how it went. Mm-hmm.
Emergent does usually mean longer.
Those two things mean often go hand in
hand. No matter how long you give it,
shit's going to emerge.
We could have gone. I mean, it could have been forever. We were like, we have to stop, but let's pick a date. And then we trained up everyone inside, and then COVID hit. We can talk later about some of the other work we're doing now, but we've evolved sort of organically into a lot of different work in community as a result of COVID. And then I just also want to really quickly lift up that at the same time that we were doing that at Washington State Reformatory, we were doing the exact same curriculum, the same circle in community with survivors. And the idea was like, it's not like different work that we want to do together. There were people like Yonah Saifu and Kathy McCoy and others who had already were organizing in community. And so we came together with survivors and did our own version of like politicized healing spaces and brought them inside, and they held circle with the folks inside and came out of that with some really clear asks to do direct dialogues with people who caused harm, which is we can talk about later, but essentially community accountability processes. What we call DAPs.
Oh, and let me get some DAP.
Hey. Oh, we've got a new. Gonna reveal some new terminology.
Wait, what does the D stand for? Direct. I'm trying to get this acronym right.
No, it's good. It's Matt's program. Matt, you want to share about it?
Dialogue and accountability process.
I just needed to know if we're gonna acronymize. I need to know what we're working with here. Yeah.
So you said we could talk about it later. Let's talk about it now. I want to unpack the ask. You know, I think there are some faulty premises that obviously keep these spaces separate, but then I do think there are some real experiential, grounded reasons why traditionally these spaces have been separate and it's been a struggle to coexist, and it has undercut accountability and perpetuated potential harm or triggers. I know that they are interrelated, and there are new possibilities if survivors' healing and accountability are happening in concert with each other. So I really would like to go to the moment of that ask, what prompted it, what was maybe the hypothesis of that moment, but fuck that if that don't help you answer the question. But yeah, that feels really important and like a very valuable fork in the road.
The folks inside who had been having these conversations about feeling that their prison sentence was not doing anything for their community or the folks that had been harmed, and yearning for something more, knowing that there has to be something more that they can do, something where they can practice meaningful accountability, you know, do something of meaning instead of just sitting by and being punished. And at the same time, having relatives on the community who are connected to their survivors, telling them that the people who they harmed are in a worse shape than the day that they were harmed, the day that they lost their loved ones. Like understanding that healing was not happening. And then the same thing with the Survivor Advisory Board, that's the survivor circle that was on the outside. They had experienced the criminal legal system and what it had to offer them in terms of justice. And it was not healing. They wanted something else. Folks put together a team to meet that need. You know, folks were having folks in community say, hey, we want to talk to the person who harmed us, which is illegal. Like, you cannot have conversations with your named victims, right? that's what the system is called then, with the survivors. And we are having folks from community reach inside the prison and say, hey, this person is sending word to you. And then you can't answer back because you will be punished, right? You can't say, I'm sorry. Oh yeah, tell them I'm sorry. This is what I'm doing. I can only imagine that this is what you are living with, that this is the pain and the loss that I have caused you. I couldn't say any of that, you know, because of the criminal legal system.
I was not aware of any such laws. That,
yeah, no contact order. Lifetime no contact order. You get 5 years in prison for it. Martina, do you want to add some things in there?
Yeah, I would just add the origin story of every project that has emerged is also not linear. Like, what we know is that, and is true from my experience, is that more than half of people who experience serious violence don't call the cops to begin with. The vast majority of people who are experiencing serious violence already are opting out. Some of that might be political, right? Like, some of that might be like, I'm politicized, I'm not going to call the cops. Vast majority of it is pragmatic. It's like, I don't see a tangible way that that is going to keep me safe. Or if the person who's causing harm is in my home, that will destabilize the well-being of my children and our ability to pay rent, right? Like, there's so many reasons. Or maybe it's that I'll experience retaliation from someone in the neighborhood. Like, whatever the reasons might be, most people don't engage the legal system. And when they do, most cases don't go to all the way to trial. Most people plea out. And there's not an opportunity for survivors of harm to get to be witnessed and held in their own survivorship, to get to share the stories of what's happened to them and to be heard in their own humanity. There's not an opportunity for them to ask for what they actually need, right? Like, if we understand the experience of violence as one that is fundamentally characterized by a lack of agency, like, no one chooses to be harmed. So much of what happens besides physical wounds, besides everything else, is this experience of total powerlessness. And then the criminal legal system does the same thing, right? Like, courts do the same thing. You don't have a choice. I didn't have a choice about what happened. And so the balm to that is establishing a sense of agency, is getting to rebuild power inside of myself or in my community or in my family. And that is one offer that RJ and TJ, Restorative and Transformative Justice, have at their core, is this ability to say, like, yeah, what you're asking for is worthy of being heard. And the other thing I'll add is that the person who's caused harm is often, like, stuck in time as this monster that did this horrible thing. And that doesn't feel good for either party, right? Like, it's actually not like an image that is in service of my own healing to not be able to see the humanity in other people. And so part of the power of sitting across from the person who's caused you harm is this ability to humanize on all sides. And that is by all means in service of our healing. And so that's what we're able to do. And we call it DAPS because we were in this, like, we could talk about it, but we were in this conversation about the tensions between restorative and transformative justice and how much people really sit in one camp or the other oftentimes. And
I think a lot of folks may still use those terms interchangeably.
Yeah.
And so as you explain some of this tension, could you give your understanding of how they're distinct?
Sure. Some of the creators of this work are, like, the people I've learned this from. So now I'm nervous to botch it, but
you only got to be an expert on what you remember. Yeah, you don't got to be an expert on what they said.
Botch away. Okay. We've been up here botching for years. Don't worry.
We're playing bocce.
Well, like, what? Okay. So one of the reasons we landed on DAPS, on dialogue and accountability processes, is that we were like, what we do is not purely community accountability, because we do work with people, like, as Matt, as you named it, who are in the belly of the beast. We work with people who are incarcerated, work with people who are pretrial. We work with people when they've come home, and we work with people totally outside the system when cops have never been called at all. So it spans the spectrum of where people are at in the process. That's not the determining factor for us. And so it didn't feel accurate to call it community accountability. At the same time, the kinds of restorative justice that is attached to the criminal legal system is often based in the Department of Corrections or in prosecutors' offices. And that is called a victim-offender dialogue, which is, like, language we don't use and also not the way we move. And so that didn't feel true for us either. And so I can't remember how we came up with it, but we came up with DAPS. We're like, it sounds good. It's fun to say. It's accurate. It's like not prescriptive. It's a dialogue and an accountability process. And that just feels true for how we're going to do it. And so instead of having like a specific set of language that is prescriptive in how we move, we have sort of a set of values and questions we ask ourselves to say, like, where are we going to put our resources and time? And we are pretty particular about that. So I'm going to let Matt talk about that because he's got it down more than me. But the piece of it that was true for us in that, like, that tension of restorative and transformative justice is that RJ and TJ are overlapping but very distinct paradigms and movements that they emerge from. And TJ is very much rooted in a clear politic of abolition, a clear critique of the state, and kind of was birthed out of organizing around gender-based violence, around primarily femmes and queer folks and people of color who were seeing the way that the prison industrial complex was getting propped up as a solution to interpersonal violence and saying, like, nah, not in my name. And that's how TJ emerged. And RJ has a more complicated history, some of which is based in indigenous roots of peacekeeping, some of which I think is not, some of which is really from victim rights movement, some of which is from Eastern Mennonite University and the work of Howard Zaire and the Mennonites there that have incredible peacemaking work. And it's like not clear when someone says they do restorative justice what their politics are. And some of that is because of co-optation. It's now like on prosecutors' websites. And because of that, you can be clear about the processes that are used. Like, okay, they sit in circle, they do these certain things, but not clear on how that project forwards the work of abolition or forwards the work of liberation. And yet there's like absolutely incredible tools and wisdom that has come out of the restorative justice movement. So we use both. We're like TJ politic, RJ practices, they go together.
I like thinking of it as tools rather than like this is ideologically where we live. It's like these are different skills we can bring and be adaptive the way y'all are describing. And so before we get into the specifics of those processes, I just want to get clarity on one thing, which we were saying legally it is punishable for someone who's committed harm to be in contact with the person who they harmed. And then you're talking about now through the structure, there is opportunity for people to be in that dialogue. How have y'all maneuvered around those legal restrictions? It just seems like it would be a real challenge to build space where that can happen while, as you put it, like that existing within the confines of the belly of the beast.
One of the useful ways that we've been able to mitigate harm when someone is ensnared in the criminal legal system is by signing on with the criminal defense team as an expert, court-appointed expert. And we partner with them, you know, and that's one way that we've been able to get in. There's attorney-client privilege. We are protected from being subpoenaed. We can continue to check in with folks. Hey, is this in the best interest of your client? Is your client protected here? Continue to check in with the person who's allegedly caused harm and be like, hey, is this what you want? Are you sure? That's one way that we've been able to do it when someone is just charged pre-conviction. Martina, you want to talk about another one?
Yeah, I was just going to say that the thing that Matt referenced is no contact orders, which are almost always part of a court case, but not necessarily. There's been a couple times that we've had a DAP where we went and like looked it up in the court and we're like, ooh, they forgot to put your name down. Like, we're good. and so that does happen. And it's changed over the years. Like the practices aren't the same. Sometimes we've worked on DAPs that are like 30 years old or 25 years old, and they didn't used to list everybody necessarily. They would just say something broad. And then when it is, like Matt said, we can work with the legal team, the defense team. Usually there's a lot of education there because they're like, what are you talking about? What is this thing you're going to do? And we try to share with them that we won't do anything that'll undermine the legal strategy. And that it might be in service of everybody involved. In that case, yeah, like we're protected if we become part of the team. But the other way is to get the no contact orders lifted. And we've done that too. Like, we're just trying shit, to be honest. We're like, oh, there's a thing. What can we do? We call around. We figure it out. Sometimes we get attorneys to work with us. And then other times it's outside the system, in which case we don't have to navigate that in quite the same way.
I have real curiosities of how the survivor engagement works out in these processes and what that point of connection looks like. Obviously, the justice and air quote correctional systems. Air quote that justice too. Double air quote. Air quote. Okay. Air quote justice and correctional systems do not prevent, heal, adequately respond to harm. They perpetuate it, but it does allow for a mapping, right? Like we can then through court cases, through the jail, through the prisons, find, create programs that, you know, allow direct contact with folks who've been involved in harm. But from the other side, how do you get in contact with survivors? Do you screen for, because we talked to Shira Hassan and Dina from Just Practice. One of the things they named is that there is a limit to TJ work for folks who are not invested in abolitionist politics, right? So, and you have to be sensitive because you're meeting someone at something that's traumatizing. And so are they finding you? Are these folks who've been harmed that are already connected to healing communities? Is there a screen? I don't want to keep making hypotheticals. I think you see where my curiosity is leading.
Yeah. How are people finding y'all to build these dApps?
Thanks, Daniel.
I do it a number of ways. So everyone that we know, everyone we work with is impacted. All these HEAL participants, the HEAL Circle participants, right? When you go through HEAL, I will tell you, it's been my experience. It's like, imagine if there was no fire. You have discovered fire. Imagine all the people you would run and tell.
Like, yo, this shit is hot.
After cooking always food on the fire, yeah. Right? Yeah. After being
taste this crunch,
right? Yeah. After seeing it dance, uh-huh. Imagine all you would tell everyone you love, everyone you know. You would tell all these people about this.
I started blurting this plant. Shit got tripped out. Yeah, I'm with
this.
You
is politicized healing work, right? You're telling everyone, and they're telling everyone, and then you know we work with the folks who are most likely to experience violence. We know that violence happens between people who know each other. It's interpersonal violence. Community has relationship with community. You know, through a person, to a person, to a person who's in relationship, they hear about a thing and they want more, or we do processes and folks are experiencing that is also in addition to circle. And then they're like, hey, I heard you guys do this thing. I don't know what it is, but they know that their needs are not being met.
I don't want to move past how much I love the fire metaphor. I'm here with you. We are cooking.
I ain't been using it like that, but
oh no, throw that. Keep that going. Keep that going.
Yeah,
the piece that feels so important that Matt said is that like the fact that folks are in community is how this all works. When people talk about restorative and transformative justice, like, it's got lessons for our movements globally, but it's hyper-local for a reason. Someone goes through circle and then tells their auntie about it. Then their auntie wants to go through circle next. And then once they've gone through circle, they're like, you know what? Now that I've experienced this thing, like I might actually want to talk to the person who's caused me harm. And then they go through it and then they want to tell someone. And that's often how it happens. There are times where the person on the other side, like the person who's caused harm, is the one that really wants a thing. They often have a sense of whether or not the person who was harmed or their family members are interested because they're in community. They're like, I know for a fact that like the person who I harmed's sister wants this thing because I'm hearing about it. They hear about it before anyone else does. And so they call us and then we can get the word out for someone to call us and they'll do that. And so there's ways that we kind of circumvent and subvert because we have like information from community and we navigate through community with community. And that feels like how it is all possible. And then there's times where like Matt was starting to talk about a process that was attached to the court's pretrial. We also had one recently that was post-conviction. So a person who caused harm came home and bumped into the person who was the daughter of the man he killed. And ironically, they both had just gone through our circles, like separately. She figured out kind of that it might be him. Like she recognized him and then saw his name and called me. And was like, I think this is this person. Can you tell me whether or not it is? And I know that person. So I call Matt. I'm like, is this the person? And he's like, I don't know. Let me figure it out. And then he calls around and he's like, yep. And we're like, yes. So in 30 minutes, we've like figured out that yes, in fact, that's true. And so I called her back and said, like, you're right. And she was really emotional She didn't know that he had come home. She was like, we must live in the same neighborhood or in the same community. They do the same kind of work. And she's like, I want to talk to him because I don't want to be surprised next time.
I just, as you're telling this beautiful story, I just want to also note how I'm hearing the failure of the state again.
Right. And that's because she actually wasn't listed as a named victim, which is why we were able to do, like, there's not a no contact order for her name. And she's not anywhere on the documents and they don't reach out to her. And yet she's his daughter. She's an incredible force in the world doing this work. Actually, she does restorative justice work herself. And she was like, I want to talk to him. I want to share with him what the impact has been for me. Like, I've never gotten to share what it's been like to grow up without my dad. And I want to hear his story. Like, I want to know who he is. And when I see him, I don't want to just see him as the monster that causes harm in my life. I want to see him as a whole human, regardless of what that is. She wasn't sure yet. You know, she was like, I don't know. And she was also mad and sad and all the things, right? But she was like clear about what she wanted. And Matt grew up with him. I was like, yep, I got this.
I grew up in prison, 17 years old. I was in there for 15 years. And one of the people that helped raise me was this person who did 25 years for causing harm. I admired him for a lot of reasons. And when he came home, we were ready for him. We had a place for him. And we did not know that there would be a process that came out of it. When we talk about like lessons being learned, you know, I think we're now more intentional. Like, oh man, these guys are in circle. Maybe we should do some looking into it could be a good thing to check if who's on the other side of that harm.
I think because Matt had this relationship and I had relationship, it wasn't like we're these like formal professionals who now have to sign documents and do this long 6-month trust building process. We were like, okay, yep, let's hop on it. And I want to say like this all happened in October and like we had done the process by December. And we're just like, yeah, we're like, all right, yeah, let's circle up. Let's talk. Let's do it. Matt worked with him and I worked with her. And then we came together. And on the day that they sat together, we broke bread and ate food and sat in ceremony. And it was a moment for me where I get to be reminded why I'm in the work and why this work is absolute magic. But that is all made possible because of the relationship, because things are embedded in community, because people know each other. And it's like specifically what we're talking about when we say we need to build the skills in our communities. There's things like that. And there are lots of survivors are not a monolith. People who cause harm are not a monolith. They don't all want the same things. They're not all ready for the same things. We're not trying to say that, but there's enough people that want something that looks like this that I don't even think we don't even need to go there to convince the ones that don't, because we got years and years and years ahead of us just responding to the people that are asking for this before we even have to get to that question.
So one thing about that I've seen in healing and the justice, air quote justice system, is that they both kind of dance around this universal reality that's been just like a part of civilizations and like the centrality of revenge and vengeance. I think a lot of times when we talk about healing or we talk about accountability, I have experienced us sidestepping the fact that a lot of our religious texts, a lot of our nation state mythologies, a lot of our, you know, fables, are you know, TV shows, the hero's journey is often like the samurai who lost their family and like now their whole Kill Bill story is about revenge and vengeance. And we all get this like collective pleasure from it. And so that is what carceral system is like, it is not about accountability. It is a centralized state controlled operation of revenge. We are going to hurt people that hurt people is like the whole name of the game, and then pat ourselves on the back for doing it. And so for folks who are engaged in conflict, or particularly the survivors that you are working with, is there something in the circle space? Is there values and principles, or is it something that comes up and we still need to learn how to move with and hold? But how does revenge, vengeance, retribution, and navigating just how ever-present that is in our consciousness show up for y'all and y'all's work?
Yeah. We make space for, just because you want something different does not mean that you don't have to feel whatever you're feeling. Mad, angry, rage, revenge, wanting your pound of flesh. And we don't count you no less than, you know, a whole-ass human who's deserving of having all their needs met. And what I believe is that when we experience harm, we experience trauma. What our healing justice coach says, Teddy McGlynn Wright, that trauma is a disruption and a rupture in safety, agency, dignity, and belonging. So we know when folks have experienced serious harm, that that rupture, that damage, that is what needs to be repaired. That is the underlying need that needs to be repaired. And that is why we are there. Wherever they're at in their process, we are there to hold them, to remember that this is what they need. They get to go through their whole process around how they get that need met. And we're there to hold that space and hold them sacred in that. And as far as like the criminal legal system, serving justice is to uphold the power that they have, the wealth that they want, and to say, all right, this thing happened. This is a quick fix. We're done with it.
Right.
And they are not concerned about healing or any of that. They tell you what you need, but perpetuating the cycle of harm is not, it's not making us any safer. They're not consulting with survivors. We have survivors show up to court hearings and say, I don't want this in my name. Survivors who have survived the most horrible pain and loss and still tell the prosecutors and tell the state and tell the judge, this is not what I want at sentencing. And prosecutors sit there and say, hey, this guy's going to tell you this thing, this victim. We're not here to serve him. We are here to serve the state and what the community wants. Punish this person. We sit in courtrooms and that happens. They're not restoring the sense of agency for survivors. They're not serving any of those needs, their dignity, their belonging in community. They just told the survivor they're not part of community. It's terrible. It fills you with rage. It's laughable. It's puts you in a hysteria. What the fuck is happening? What is happening right now? Yeah.
There's two parts. Like, on the one hand, we reach for what we know. And when we're sold a myth that revenge, that punishment, that prisons are what make us whole again, it makes sense that people reach for that. And especially if it's that or nothing, like what else is offered to you? And that is part of us replicating the logics of the state. And then we do that in our, like, as you know, in our own communities, in our organizing spaces. I do it, you know, collective justice is not exempt from all the challenges that we're trying to uproot. Like, we have them inside of our own collective. We have them inside of ourselves. And so much of the work of getting free from those systems is also getting free inside of yourself. But one of our collective members and one of our founding Survivor Advisory Board members said one time to me, like, I believe in this work with everything I have. And on a good day, I want to break everyone free myself. And on a bad day, I want to, like, kill them myself, right? Like, I am a person who's experienced serious, serious harm. And the person who caused him harm was never arrested. And he was like, it's not like I've arrived at a place where I'm an all-knowing, all-being. And so that feeling of, like, grace and compassion doesn't mean that you don't ever also feel anger and revenge and frustration and a desire to punish. Like, it makes sense that that comes up from time to time.
And so it sounds like, acknowledge that that's part of what people bring, just like all the other things that people bring, and move through it.
Yeah. The thing that Matt said about the underlying needs, Miriam Kaba shared this one time with me when I was just starting to learn about transformative justice, and I've carried it with me in all the processes I do, which is that she said, like, our job is to figure out what is underneath the demands.
It's just true.
Not to be reactive and responsive to those demands. And that's how we make sure that our work is survivor-centered, but isn't dictated by, like, whatever the whims are of the survivor that you're working with.
The difference between center and led.
Yes. And so a survivor comes to me and says, like, I want this out of the process. And that's aligned. And so we say yes, and we start doing it. And then partway through, you know, like, people are feeling frustrated. The process we were just talking about, like, partway through that, this was a survivor who came with so much of her own healing done, such clear politics, and knew why she wanted to be in the space. And then partway through was like, this isn't going fast enough. Like, why is it taking so long? And when we said it's taking so long because the person who just came home isn't stable, he's figuring out housing and basic needs. And that's part of this, is that he is well enough to show up well for you. And she was like, yeah, I mean, I've waited 25 years, so I'm pretty sure he could hurry up. And she came with some heat for Matt and I. And our job is not to say like, oh, look at her flipping on her values. Our job is to say like, what of that demand has truth to it? And so much of it does. And like, what's underneath that demand? That demand is about the fact that she's sitting with anxiety and frustration and pain in the unknown. And so how do we help her calm inside of her own body so that she can stay present, so that she can sleep at night while she's waiting for this process to happen? That demand we can respond to.
Again, crisp and clear, especially how you name it now. But I'm curious, in real time, you know, without getting into the details, I can understand you mentally being able to accept it, but how did it register for you in your body and in showing up when the heat came for you, right? Because I think that's the, for folks listening who are just practicing, the folks who are just entering the space or have desire, I think that's one of the real fears, or for folks who've participated and then left the space or are wary to continue, right? Like, oh, this ain't new for me. I've done it. And that heat, to maybe go back to the fire metaphor, like, you know, kind of snapped and bit at me somewhat. And so for y'all, as folks who are practiced, were you comfortable? Were you able to maneuver through that? Or was there a struggle to experience some of that heat? You're like, I'm just trying to help, you know? Like,
Matt is so calm under pressure, but I was like, ooh, we fucked up. Uh-huh. And looked to him and he's like, it's going to be okay. But I totally spun out. And this is why, like, our elders and the folks who've been in practice in this work, even not our elders, even our folks who've been in practice who just aren't directly attached to this one, they're not so deep in that they don't.
Our
young elders.
Or sometimes it's just other people.
Other people. Just other wise people. Yeah.
Someone who ain't here is what I need.
Just shout out y'all.
Y'all and them.
This is where it's like, a process is so many people. Because, you know, we called Sandra Rodriguez, who's now at Ahimsa Collective in California doing this work, and Karina Montag, who's also in California doing this work with Stronghold. And we called both of them and said, like, what do we do? This person is like feeling really frustrated with the process and wants it to happen tomorrow. She wants to happen yesterday. And our assessment is that, like, yeah, she's ready. And our assessment is that he's getting there, but he needs some supports in place. We wanted it to not be destabilizing for him. And they both just like talked us down and in some ways calmed my spirit and reminded us that regardless of like what we've been taught, of like, these are the things to look for, these are the steps to have in place before you sit two people down together. Like, if she's going in informed, she could choose to do that. And so instead we went back to her and said like, okay, if you don't hear XYZ, if you do hear XYZ, if this happens or if this happens, do you still want to do it? And she was like, yep. And so we did it. We did it earlier than we anticipated initially. And it was the right move. If it wasn't for other people reminding us to like trust our own guts and trust her and what she was asking for, I think we would have stalled. We would have been like, no, we need to stay with our schedule. And it was an example of putting the agenda or the schedule aside and responding to what was emergent and responding to what needed to be tended to. That was what happened for me.
What I'm hearing throughout this conversation is a like willingness to adaptability and responsiveness that doesn't shift the values that you're bringing, but it shifts the practice of what you're doing. And that can be in this person-to-person dialogue, that can be in how you're maneuvering and moving through, around, behind the state. There's a like, we know what we're here to do, but how we do it is not static. We're going to figure out the different pathways to, you know, make this fire dance, basically.
Back to the fire analogy. Good job.
If there's one thing we can do, y'all do all that other shit. We just extend metaphors.
Yeah. Hours on end.
and speaking of, I'm thinking about how, you know, the point of this show is for people who are doing similar work and starting to build their own experiments in this. I think that adaptability is a really big piece. And I'm wondering what else, you know, if someone was stepping into trying to build a container similar to what y'all have made, what else would you want them to carry with them into that creation process when, as they build their own experiment?
I always think about the bowls. Another thing, one of our healing justice coaches, Teddy, shout out Teddy again, teaches us about our bowls. So there's the bowl of relative wellness, which is the bottom bowl that all the other bowls fit into. This is another analogy.
Mm-hmm. I love it.
Or like salad bowls in a cabinet. Yeah, yeah.
The bowl of relative wellness.
I'm going to be honest. I think both Damon and I heard it as the Bulls, and we thought you were about to give a basketball analogy. So tell us more. That's the Chicago. Yeah. That's what happens when you talk to people in Chicago.
Yeah.
And yeah. And Philly folks, no, he's not saying young bull. He's bowl. B-O-W-L.
Bowl. Yeah, for real. So, well, let me back up. So there's our bowl, which we hold our skills, sits within our bowl of self-awareness, which sits in our bowl of relative wellness. We can only access our skills to the depth of our relative wellness. So the need to tend to our relative wellness is imperative if we want to access the self-awareness and skill that it takes to do what we need to do.
I'm hearing from that, become more well, to become more self-aware. And from there, you can become more skilled, which is very simple.
I mean, and impossible under living under racial capitalism and all the things.
Yeah, right. Simple, but not easy.
Yeah, and it's not on us. It's on the collective, you know, also.
I think that is huge. I think in RJTJ, people often want like the skill. They're like, well, what's the skills? Like, what did this prescriptive process, Howard Zaire talks about, like RJ is a compass, not a map. And so that's where we get clear about values and direction. And then what Matt said, skill or no skill, it's really about quality of presence that we're bringing and clarity of like our political commitments. And then a lot becomes possible. And so I think the wellness piece is huge. And for me personally, I'll say that can't be done in isolation. Like Matt and I are sitting here talking to you, but we represent a collective of people who each bring their own brilliance to the work. And I learn from them every day. And the people that we get to sit in circle with, like none of this would be possible without that. And so tending to wellness, tending to deep relationship, remembering to slow down. If all you do is like one process and you do it slowly and intentionally and well held by community, well held by a group of people around you, learning the skills and supporting alongside you, then you have a prototype to keep building off of, right? But if we're moving quick and we're trying to like produce and be reactive and in what feels like crisis management mode, then we fall short of our values and we treat each other poorly and we lose sight of our political commitments and our hope. It's not sustainable. And so that would be the thing I would say for other people practicing out there is like have a community of practice. And inside of that deep belonging, you can start getting creative and you can start making mistakes and know that you'll be held.
I have one follow-up that what you were speaking to is like pointing towards, and if this don't land or resonate, we could just cut. It just wind out because I think we're at such a great place. But yes, this comes up all the time. Folks listen to the show for some of the work we do out in the world. Folks wanting a playbook, right? And like really what this becomes is like guiding folks through. There is no playbook. And honestly, there will likely be no playbook, right? Like we could build strategies and we could fine tune our compasses and build up our values. But this is always going to be emergent and will never be institutionalized. And so there is no do's and don'ts that we can make. But I'm curious if from experience, we can do some don'ts. You know, like it might be hard to get the do's and don'ts as a list, but the don'ts by himself from the experience, are there things that like, okay, I know this is emergent and every situation is different, but now that I've gone through this experience, I know to not do this, especially because the work y'all do is so high level and so risky, right? And it requires so much vulnerability and it's people's deepest need. So are there any don'ts because these processes are susceptible to manipulation?
Don't take money that restricts your autonomy.
Mm-hmm.
That's big.
Mm-hmm. Ever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ever.
Don't stop saying what's true. So like, because we know that people are in the belly of the beast. We work with people who are incarcerated and we have to be thoughtful about how we navigate courts and the criminal legal system. And if we get to the point where we can't speak our truth because of that, we're doing something wrong. And don't center yourself our egos can really lead us astray. Don't lose your own humanity inside of a fight for others' humanity.
You are spitting. I'm just right now. I'm so glad I asked this question. That was just off the top. Wow. Again, more fire. Maddie, I'm just curious if you have any experiential don'ts that you have to share.
I was going to say the money one for sure. Like she already said. So
yeah. I have one more. I think Prentice Hemphill talks about innocence. The work is about challenging narratives that simplify us and dehumanize us. And one of those is the like narrative of the innocent victim. And I think in organizations or collective struggles, we also sometimes take on that narrative for ourselves. Like we never mess up. We never fumble. We never have internal conflict. We never cause harm because I'm in this work of repairing harm and doing anti-violence. And that's just not true. Like we hurt each other all the time. We make huge mistakes. We learn so much from the fumbles, from the mistakes, from the like balls dropped, from the overpromising, from the not acknowledging our own capacity, from saying the wrong thing at the wrong time. And so like, don't like, aim for perfection or innocence and like let all of our mistakes be lessons.
And we're done.
That's it. That's the perfect end note.
Lastly, just on a very tangible level, if there are folks who want to connect to the work that y'all are doing, either to continue learning from y'all, to plug in to some of the work that y'all do as facilitators, if they need access to process, if they, you know, if they want to get in touch, what's the best way for folks to connect with y'all? If you want them to connect, also.
Our website, they can sign up on our listserv. We don't send a ton of emails and bother people, but we do send out like trainings and resources a lot. And they can also connect with any of us through our website to ask for a process.
As we close out, I just want to thank y'all both so much, one, for taking the time with us, but also just for the generosity and care of the work you do. In this powerfully understated, in our conversation way, I'd like see the just the depth of what y'all are carrying and what you do. So thank you for bringing your lives and your intention and your hearts to this meaningful work that's transforming the lives of people and communities.
Man, thank you guys for doing the work that you guys are doing. It's one thing that one of the things that we are trying to do is leave more evidence.
Mm. Right? Shout out Mia Mingus.
Mm-hmm. You know, to amplify our voices, our stories, you know, and all the voices of our people, communities, folks out there doing the work. Thank you guys so much for that.
All right. Collective Justice was here. They shared their thoughts, their experiences. I feel like I learned a ton in that conversation. And as always, we got to welcome our partner in decriminalization back into the convo. Eva, welcome back for the peer review. What's jumping out to you from this conversation?
Hoping I don't offend all my peers.
There's so many things that stick out, but I want to start with saying, you know, there's something Martina said. She was talking about survivors and, you know, really reclaiming agency and really being a part of reclaiming their safety and their community safety. And what she said was, unlike the criminal justice system, you know, what we think is to you survivors, what you are asking for is worthy of being heard. That is what collective justice does so well, is to say to survivors, you're worthy of being heard. And for those of you out there who have been listening to survivors, who are survivors, who work survivors, you know that they're leading this work to heal communities, to make sure that, in Martina's words, that we are in service to our own healing, that the people who cause harm aren't stuck in time, aren't stuck out of community, that we are in these relationships, that's the reality, and that we work to heal, to make them stronger, to make them better. And also acknowledge that we've all got feelings, and that just because we want to live in this abolitionist wonderscape, that there's going to be anger and heartbreak and desire for revenge along the way and all of those things. And so this episode for me, again, as Damon said, was just so crisp on this whole global view of what TJ can do in our communities, what collective justice demonstrates can and is being done right now and has been done for the last 10 years for these lineages of many decades, of many centuries. And I really hope that people are able to take this and see that there's hope for all of our communities.
Yeah, absolutely. In addition to noting the crispness, I found myself regularly in awe because of what collective justice offers and reminds us. All of the work that we have documented and all the work that happens in community and, you know, on people's blocks and in people's living rooms and in kitchens is important and part of this project. But there is something I think particularly striking for me, as we say, for the work being done in the belly of the beast, or that is most directly engaging harm and violence that is real in our community. And I think that is something, as people within abolitionist spaces and people who look seriously at abolitionist spaces desire more of. Like, how do we have more concrete conversations about the harms? And I feel like that's where a lot of the distress comes from. And so to create a community, again, in the institution that is the epitome of harm, as a way to map through community pathways towards repair is really, I think, like the nugget that so many people need to understand is possible in terms of the experiments that we're building. And so we may not have the answer. And as Miriam says, and what you know, sparked all of this, there is no one replacement. We need a million of these experiments. But I think this one right here is a place where the answers can be formulated because the organizing is so direct and so experience-based and driven. So that as an offering is such a gift. And then it also serves as this really explicit reminder of that the system that we have in no way is organized around accountability and repair. And this language of justice and judicial process not only fails or falls short in creating true accountability or healing, it is actually antithetical, as we learned through some of just the processes they have to navigate. And so, you know, the criminalization around contact, the binary of guilty and not guilty, like the whole court process does not serve in addressing the real harm. And so to have Matt really embody and introduce himself, you know, as a community member, as a builder, but as someone who has done severe harm in his community, you know, he said that within the first few seconds of speaking, right? Like that type of model building, that type of organizing is not only healthy and humanizing, right? But in terms of like people's imagination can be sparked towards, oh, this is the type of system we need to build. And so I'm so grateful to Collective Justice for sharing their work with us, but doing the work most importantly.
Yeah. And him saying that didn't like disqualify him from the conversation. In fact, it actually like gave him uniquely needed perspective in this work. And it showed how the pathway toward that participation and that transformation came from the very processes that he's now helping to facilitate. And like we've said that throughout, Damon, it's a thing that I remember you saying a long time ago of like the people who are most transformed, and we were talking about direct action, but I think it applies here too, are the participants. And that doesn't mean that everyone will go on to be a facilitator and, you know, devote their life to it. But yes, it's great that this space is happening for many reasons, including that it builds the pathways for more people who have been affected, both as people who've committed harm and people who have been harmed, to then have a hand in shaping what the structure is to help them heal. Because we heard it over and over again in this, that like so much of interpersonal violence is about the removal of agency and autonomy. And then you step into the system and the system does the same thing again, and you don't really even get to choose or have a hand in shaping what that looks like. And so it was just moving to encounter a space where his experience as someone who has committed harm doesn't disqualify him, and that there's space for him to transform, not just to like, quote, heal that one harm, but to also like contribute to making that possible for more people.
They talk about it, right? I mean, Martina and Matt, it was kind of funny. They're like, are you going to tell the story? Are you going to tell the story? Who's going to tell the history? Because it's so personal, like the history, the legacy of collective justice, as they say in this episode, are their stories. It's like, ding, 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 put a dollar in the coin jar. We're going to like quote Ella Baker here, or But I think that this is a good barometer for the experiments that you're seeing around you too, right? It always comes back to attending to these relationships. And I was thinking too, you know, something that I've been thinking about all these months after we wrapped with Miriam is we say community a lot. We say practice community. We say our like hyper-local communities, et cetera, et cetera. There's this zine that I've been meaning to make for forever. And of course, there's no time, called Porchside Abolition. And it's like trying to name who that community is, because I feel like in our work, the resounding answer we get when we're asking people to activate, to come together, to collectivize, to work on projects, is they're like, with whom? You know, like, I don't have a community. And so I want to say for myself, when I'm throwing this word around in these episodes and when I'm calling people to action in that sense, I mean, whoever the people are around you, like, it doesn't have to be, you know, your neighbor who you've known for 10 years. It could be your new, like you have to build it. Like, And I think, you know, that's a scary answer and a daunting answer. But if you're looking around you and you don't know who your community is, it means you need to find one or you need to build one. And so that's not the barrier to work. That is the work.
And when you really do that, especially in relationship to the belly of the beast, like, there's precarity and vulnerability and riskiness that can come with that. And you don't have to be doing work inside of prisons in order for that riskiness to exist. Like, we've documented that, whether that's the Philly Community Bail Fund conversation, across the board, it can be risky and precarious as a single person. It can be as an organization, as a community. And like, we can't promise that that risk won't be there, but we can promise that the thing that will enable transformation and protection is that communal work, and that you're more protected together than you are alone.
Daniel, you know what that was?
What?
That was crisp. That was really crisp, because, you know, one thing that, like, I wanted folks to hold from this conversation is, as we celebrate, right, like, our amplification of all of these projects is not to project perfection. So when they talk about these processes, we don't want these folks to seem like transformative angels that come from above, or like are a different species. Like, as they're playing out the relationship networks of like, oh, I know someone who can call me when they are triggered by someone who caused such a deep loss in their life. And I know the person who caused that harm, and we can create a process around that. And that sounds like a great success story. But in holding that, there is human complication. There is difficulty. There is obstacle. It doesn't go as fast as we need it. There is frustration. The person who we hope to center or provide healing for can become disgruntled with the process. And, you know, it's not about you, but you are the one holding it. You're the one responsible. And so, like, to learn that that is part of the work, that that is the work too, of like fumbling and through this messiness, it's kind of unsettling, but also really comforting to learn that that's part of what we should expect.
I loved that part.
You're not doing it wrong if you're having conflict. You're
doing that's right.
Human work.
Yeah.
When Martina was like, you guys, what I did was spiral the fuck out, you know, like, I mean, like, that's so real.
Shout out for sharing that.
Yeah. And it's like, that's like, to go back to like practice communities, I mean, what it is, or there's just so many concentric circles radiating out until everybody's involved, because like, everybody needs the ability to phone a friend. We are all that we have.
And y'all are about to go back to not having us. So sorry, but we're going to hop out of the lab. Maybe you'll hear us with some bonus episodes. Maybe you'll find us on the road this year. Thank you all for listening, being part of this experiment with us. You can find the work of Interrupted Criminalization at interruptedcriminalization.com, and check out the whole One of Me universe at millionexperiments.com. We're at Respair Media and at Ergo Radio. And yeah, maybe we'll see you back in the lab soon too.
The suspense is rising. Much love to the people.
Peace.